Hi everyone, and welcome to tonight's event on the convention on the rights of the child. My name's Ravini Layton, and I'm the national president of UN Youth Australia, and we have quite a large contingent of the UN Youth Australia National Conference delegates and facilitators here tonight. And we are here tonight for a call to action on children and young people's rights following Australia's review under the Convention on the Rights of a Child. Tonight is part of the University of Melbourne's Australia's Role in the World series and is supported by UN Youth Australia, the Australian Institute of International Affairs, Vision Generation under World Vision, and SNAKE, the National Peak Body of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Children. I would like to now invite Geraldine Atkinson, Deputy Chair of SNAKE, to give tonight's acknowledgement of country.
I was asked by Chris if I would do a welcome. Well, I can't really do a welcome because I'm not a member of the Kulin Nation. I'm actually from my mob's from up further north on the Murray River. My mother was a Bangarang woman, and my father was further up in New South Wales. He was a Wiradjuri man. But tonight, I'd like to join with all of you in acknowledging that we are on the land of the Kulin Nation. That it is in actual fact the land of the Wurundjeri people, a very proud, very clan group that exists here along with the Bunurong people. The Kulin Nation is wide and extensive. And what I would like to do is pay my respects to their elders, past and present, and I would like to pay respects to elders that are present here tonight. Thank you.
Thank you, Geraldine. Tonight's theme is children's rights in a changing world. Our world is more interconnected than ever before. We can become aware of information instantly. We have so many resources at our fingertips. We have made continuing commitments to human rights throughout the world. And in this modern and changing world, it is particularly important to champion child rights, the rights of a group of people in our world who are particularly vulnerable to human rights abuses. To give some background, the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child is the world's most ratified treaty. Its implementation throughout the world is monitored by the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child. And in June, Australia appeared before this body for the fourth time to report on our progress regarding child rights. Our speakers tonight will explore this review through a combination of reflection, observation and storytelling. Our hashtags for this evening are up on the PowerPoint next to me. They are Child Oz Rights and Oz in World. So make sure you do make good use of them throughout the night, as well as storing up questions for the question and answer session that will come after short presentations from each of our speakers. To begin with, we'll have Jan Owen. Jan Owen is the CEO of the Foundation for Young Australians and a pioneer in the youth sector. From 2002 to 2010, Jan was Executive Director of Social Ventures Australia. And prior to this, Jan founded the CREATE Foundation and was its CEO for 9 years. She has been awarded membership of the Order of Australia for services to children and young people. Tonight, Jan will be speaking with us about her reflections and lessons from advocating for the well-being of Australia's children and young people. So please welcome her to the stage.
Thank you very much, everybody. And I think this is working, maybe. It's wonderful to be here, and congratulations to the 102. I heard the two makes a real difference. Who are the extra two? The 102 young people who came together, and you are all in the room tonight. I know you've had a pretty full-on few days, so I'm mightily impressed that you're here after hours and not out shopping and hanging out in Melbourne, and that you've come together for this event. I am but the very light entertainment. There are some serious heavyweights on this panel behind me, and so I'm really the warm-up act to kind of get you all in the mood for some serious conversation about children's rights. But Chris asked me to reflect on my journey as a child rights activist and young person. Of course, you're not born a child rights activist, but there are three things, and you may well ask yourself, what does lemonade, the Story Bridge, which that is in Bris Vegas, and toads have to do with anything? And those three things actually shaped me by the time I was only 10. And the reason was that when I was 10, I lived outside of Brisbane, on a kind of a big acreage, and I had this brilliant idea, because I saw it on the Brady Bunch maybe, that lemonade stands at the end of the driveway were a fantastic way to make money, and I needed to make money to, you know, buy a bike. So I did that, and I actually set up a lemonade stand. Now, the problem was that I lived 20 k's out of Brisbane, like two cars a week went past my place. Not to be deterred, though, I got the lemonade going, and I sold it to my family. I learnt a lot about leadership very soon after that, when in Brisbane toads were, and still are, if you've, is anybody here from Queensland? Let's get the Queensland. Oh, what a huge number. That's great. So we know all about toads in a very close and personal, meaningful way. And my job at a very young age was to actually, I found out that lemonades weren't going to cut it, and so I got onto toads. And what happened was my dad used to work at the University of Queensland, and we found out that actually if you delivered to the veterinarian department live toads, now this is going to get ugly for the RSPCA people in the room, live toads, then you would get paid per toad. So, of course, I got my three younger brothers in a team. I was the captain of the team, and they went out and caught toads while I stood with a torch about 50 metres away shouting at them to chase the toads. And that was my first leadership experience, really, with my three younger brothers. And then finally, at a very young age, my parents were helped set up Lifeline in Australia. And in fact, in those days, what happened was when you took the call, you actually got in your car and went to help the person who called. That's how Lifeline started. And so I would often be with my parents when they took a call or were doing counselling and somebody needed help. And so at a very young age, because we, you know, too young to be left at home, we would be bundled in the back of our car and taken to places like that beautiful looking Story Bridge where people were literally about to throw themselves off it. And my parents, I would watch in the car as my parents talked down many people. We would go to homes where the police were very disengaged in domestic violence when I was young, and that was something that happened in your own home and it was your own business. And I would go with my parents while they went and collected mothers and children from homes. And I would wake up on any morning of any day of the week and find that there was a family living on my lounge room floor. And so by the time I was 10, I got a very, very strong sense that this happened to all kinds of people, and people found themselves in all kinds of situations that they may not ever have expected to, and that what my one of the things that my family did was contribute to other in supporting other people, and particularly children, that was a very important part of our life. And so we were, you know, my parents were foster parents. So I'd learnt about entrepreneurship. I'd learnt about leadership by beating my brothers into submission, and I'd learnt about justice at a very young age. I went on to some very interesting first experiences as a young person, as a teenager really, and that shot at the left there, although it's not the real shot, was my friends and I started the first girls motor mechanics course for girls in a girls' school in Australia. And of course we knew nothing about motor mechanics, and this is sometimes where your intentions are a little bit different to what you really are doing. So there was one male teacher in our school, And we were pretty interested in him because he was the only male teacher in an all-girls school. And so one of our drivers for setting up a motor mechanics course was to get our male teacher to teach us. And he, of course, was very flattered because men are. And he said, of course I'll teach you motor mechanics. And we said, fantastic. So I got the money together. We raised money. We went and bought an old FJ Holden. It didn't run. We put it under the presbytery window where the priest was sort of looking at us strangely. And we set about doing motor mechanics. Of course, we found out within about 4.5 minutes that our male teacher knew nothing about motor mechanics. And we used to use the car for all kinds of things, like smoking and hanging out and getting out of class. But what we did do was we found out about media. And we found out that when we rang the media and said, we've got the first girls' motor mechanics class in Australia at a girls' school, they all flocked. So we quickly got on we borrowed, basically, overalls. We put grease on our faces and we took a photo pretty much like that, and we're on the front page of every single newspaper, first girls' motor mechanics. Fortunately, our dads came and saved the day and actually fixed the car, and we got it running and then sold it. More entrepreneurship. We gave that money away, by the way, to a local service. We did a fair bit of squatting, which is our little... I found out there's this awesome red thing here, but... Oh, there it is. And what we did was we really, as young advocates, actually kind of asked permission later. I shouldn't say these things in front of Alistair, but he's not in the courts anymore. But we would find disused service stations exactly like this and turn them into massive drop-in centres. And so in Brisbane, in the middle of Spring Hill, which lots of you from Brisbane know about, there was for a long time a large number of Indigenous communities that lived in inner Brisbane. And so what we did was run massive drop-in centres where, again, today there's no way on God's earth we'd be allowed to have kids hanging off those big hooks that you hook the car up with and doing, swinging up and down. But it was a fantastic experience of bringing together a community and doing great work. I ended up after that on the National Youth Council of Australia, and that was, I guess, my first experience of national advocacy. And we were running International Youth Year, and I often say there's so much about being in the right place at the right time, and I'm going to come back to that about you guys in a minute. But the idea of being in the right place at the right time, that International Youth Year, we got to set up the first traineeships program in Australia. So all the cadets and apprenticeships that you see or have heard about or experienced yourself today are all from the time when we got a youth policy for the first time ever in this country in the early 80s. And that was a pretty exciting thing to be part of. I, by the way, was pretty terrified the entire time. I had no idea who these people were. I come from Brisbane. I mean, we had a premier who used to call the media chooks, whose wife endlessly seemed to cook pumpkin scones, and where the state existed to mostly shut people down or put long driveways into his property. So this was a very interesting thing for me to go to a very big rest of the world and rest of Australia and find out that there were lots of people who thought just like me, but, you know, were way smarter than me. And it was a pretty phenomenal experience. I don't want to scare you, although even inspire you, but it was in a conference very similar to this at NYSA that I met my lifelong partner. So look around. Make the most of this, guys. And all those people that I went through that experience with at 18 and 19 are all holding amazing positions in Australia and internationally today. So the people you meet today, and even if you don't end up marrying them or hooking up with them, which is perfectly acceptable, it's absolutely fine that you... It's absolutely essential that you know each other and that you stick together and that you stay really... really close with each other. There's a couple of people down here. God, how did she know? So that was pretty. They were amazing times, and I'm so proud of the times that we spent advocating to get up policy and youth policy in Australia today that still exists from those times. I then had an incredible experience of working again with young people, and all through my career I've worked on the ground and face to face and then had opportunities to work nationally, and I couldn't have been more grateful for that opportunity to work with young people as a young person most of that time and then to actually represent or be part of big groups like this here and internationally. And one of the things that I was doing was I was working with young people and girls particularly who were in out-of-home care. And I remember we used to run facilities, and I would go into these facilities and think to myself, why on earth are these young women locked inside this facility where in fact the people who have perpetrated harm to them are actually outside walking scot-free? And I just didn't get it. And it was that led us to think and look around for what does it look like when you bring the consumers of services like out-of-home care or homeless services into the middle. And that's when I met Alistair, because I actually asked Alistair and some other people, again, a great lesson. I had ridiculous chutzpah and I just rang up people who were luminaries and still are like Alistair and said, would you please come and help us start the very first youth-led, out-of-home care youth-led consumer group in the country? And they said yes, thank goodness. And so we got incredible support. And so Create was started in a garage not unlike that. I try not to mention again with Alistair in the room that there was plenty of child labour involved with my children learning about giving back by stuffing 15,000 envelopes every couple of months to all the young people in care in Australia. They've been in therapy several times since. But it started, and then within about 3 years, we had grown this organisation to be a national organisation across Australia, led by young people who had the experience. We run the Human Rights Award for youth participation. And then we realised that it takes more than that. And so we spent a lot of time getting other people involved. We said it can't just be young people. You can't leave it to young people who are in state care to have to advocate completely for the change in the system that they deserve. And so we got workers together and we set up something called Face to Face. And every single year we would work with foster carers and youth workers and government workers to try and talk about how we could do things differently. We then said, let's got to be bigger than that, and we formed basically the Coalition for Australia's Children. It was more than just kids in care. It was about all children and young people. And we held the first National Children's Summit in Parliament House in 2000, and we had 200 people and 100 young people from care, particularly in that room, talking about what needed to change. It was an incredible experience, and still today, the greatest advocacy platform of Create, I think, is a report that we write every single year that says how are young people in care faring in Australia, how are they going compared to everyone else. And then finally, I guess, I got the incredible experience of going and working with people who I'd never worked before at Social Ventures Australia. Social Ventures is a new way of bringing investment and new thinking into the non-profit space. And so we really decided that we wanted to start supporting social entrepreneurs. So I got the chance to basically go and work with people like myself and help them get started. And that has been also, was an amazing ride. And we got to bring new money and new thinking and new ideas. So lawyers and investment bankers and people who had never been involved in thinking about the rights of children and young people and Australia and how it could be better suddenly got involved and brought their business skills, their head and their heart. And that has raised $26 million new dollars in Australia for the non-profit sector and for projects and the things that we talk about. And so here I come to today, and finally, the things that have always been my passion and have always driven me are young people. And so at FYA, I get the ridiculous privilege every single day of working with the next generation of young change makers. And what I love about the young people that we get to work with at FYA is that they, like you, have new skills and tools that we never had. If we had had social media and Twitter and Facebook like you have, it would have been phenomenal. You've got tools at your fingertips that have the power to mobilise and transform people instantly. You know, we had to write letters, long, lots of them, and stuff envelopes. These are profound tools that you have. I think that you also have incredible mentors. You have brilliant ideas and other people to help accelerate what you're doing. You need to back yourselves. You need to believe in the ideas that you come up with. It's not arrogance. Backing yourself is actually about courage. And the thing that I wish for everyone, every young person, and particularly you in this room, is the courage, the imagination, and the will to lead and learn and be the people that you can be for us all, but also for yourselves, to be who you are meant to be and to lead with passion and conviction. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jan. And do hang on to those questions because I'm sure they're buzzing in your heads. But next up, we will have the Honourable Alistair Nicholson, who was the Chief Justice of the Family Court of Australia from 1988 until 2004. A law graduate from the University of Melbourne, where we are being hosted tonight, Alistair has had a distinguished legal career and has always been a strong advocate on the rights and well-being of children and young people. And he currently chairs Children's Rights International. So tonight, Alistair, like Jan, will be sharing his lessons from having been a child advocate for many years and offering his reflections on children and law.
Thank you very much. As the oldest person here, I feel my position a bit. However, I hope I've got something that's still relevant to say to you. During my time at the bar, I couldn't have described myself then as either a children's advocate or a children's lawyer, but in fact, in those days at the bar, there weren't too many who could. Children's law was not an area that was taught very much, was not, even human rights law was not taught very much. So what you learned about it, you learned more by osmosis than you did at university and in practice. But practicing as a junior barrister when I went to the bar, we spent a lot of our time in magistrates' courts, and very instructive places to be. You really see the community, you really see how people struggle, you really see the sort of problems that they face. And we used to, in those days, appear often in maintenance cases, which were cases involving fights over whether mother and children should be maintained. And the appalling domestic violence that was so common in the community in those days, and the fact that everyone seemed to accept it as almost a norm, left me with feelings of great disquiet about how children and why children should be subjected to that sort of treatment in the home, and why women should be treated in that way in particular. And that certainly was one of the influences that affected my approach to life in the law. In 1975, the federal government in Australia passed the Family Law Act. The Family Law Act and the Family Court, which I later headed, gets a lot of abuse. But in fact, it did represent a great advance, because in those days, in children's cases, the issue as to where the child went and with what parent quite often was determined by the alleged fault of the parents. And so the fights ranged over who had committed adultery with whom and whether there'd been violence and cruelty and by whom. And the child really was almost part of the spoils to the victor. So the Family Law Act did represent a great advance because it incorporated other professionals such as psychologists and social workers, as part of the court's approach to family issues, and it removed the issue of fault from the dissolution of marriage process. That led to some later difficulties I'll mention, but it really was an extraordinary advance, and it's also worth noting that until not long before, there were different family and divorce laws in each state and territory. I spent 5 years on the Supreme Court of Victoria from 1982, and in those days, the Supreme Court had jurisdiction over children who were from unmarried parents. It was a strange anomaly that the Commonwealth only had power in relation to children of marriages. So all the rest of the children were dealt with by the Supreme Court. by judges who had very little experience of dealing with the issue at all, and without the professional services that I've referred to of counsellors, psychologists and the like. So on becoming Chief Justice of the Family Court in 1988, I came to appreciate the value of those professionals in a child court much more than I had ever done before. And that, I think, and I think it's fair to say that my experience in the position of Chief Justice of that court converted me to a strong advocate for children's rights and the importance of the law taking an entirely different approach to children than it had traditionally done. And as I've mentioned, there were a number of catalysts. One was the community attitude towards family violence. And indeed, even in the court itself in those days, the fact that if the child was subjected to violence, that was one thing. But if the mother was subjected to violence, that didn't matter if the father was. As long as the child wasn't directly affected, then what harm would it do? That was the sort of thinking that was behind a lot of people in people's approach in those days. And that was one of the things that I'm very pleased to see has changed over the years. So you'll still find that present. And the effect of family violence on children is now well known, and indeed the legislation makes it clear that children must be protected from family violence, whether it's directed at them or others in their family. Another issue that I faced when I was appointed was whether court approval was required for invasive non-therapeutic medical procedures such as the sterilisation of children. And until the High Court determined that issue in a case of Marion in 1992, there was a strong view in the community and with many on the bench that parental consent was all that was necessary for any form of medical procedure, whether it was for the benefit of the child or not. And so you had a situation where particularly children who are intellectually handicapped, female children, were sterilised almost automatically without any control or any attempt being made to determine whether that should take place or not. Now, you'll see from the recent UN committee report that will be discussed by the next speaker, there has been criticism of Australia for permitting sterilisation at all. And I think there may be some force in that, although there are differing arguments about that. But at least the issue can now not be carried out. That sort of treatment cannot be carried out without convincing a court that it's appropriate. And then a second catalyst that affected me was the attitude towards child representation and hearing the child. The Family Law Act had never specified the circumstances of why a child representative should be appointed, although it did provide for it. And some judges would never appoint a child representative because they thought they were no use. Others appointed them whether there was any real purpose in appointing them or not. And the situation was quite troublesome. And indeed, children were not being given the proper treatment that they should have been in the courts. I felt that something had to be done about that, and in a full court decision, we set out a list of circumstances where child representative appointments should be made, and that was back in 1994. That actually caused an immediate uproar through legal aid commissions in the country who said they couldn't afford to have all these children represented. So that again gives you a sort of attitude that was taken to children and young people at that time. And in fact, it was not until 2006 that there was a provision for the appointment of a children's lawyer in the family court. Contrast that with New Zealand, where children's lawyers had been appointed right from the commencement of their family court back in the early 70s. And indeed, there were children's lawyers and there were lawyers assisting the court looking after children's interests. In fact, it's interesting that the Howard government, not so very long ago, made an ill-advised move to amend legislation in relation to child abduction cases to limit the availability of child representation. And it's pleasing to see that as a result of that, and some of you will have read about a case that's going to the High Court at the moment involving an Italian father and Australian mother, and the children are resisting being sent back to the father in Italy. And the main argument that's being put to the High Court, as I understand it, is that the legislation infringes the child's right to be heard, and that therefore it should be regarded as unconstitutional, which is a, I'll be waiting with interest to see what happens to that. On the issue of children's rights to be heard, I'm still troubled by judges' reluctance to interview children in family proceedings in Australia. There's a judge has always had the right to interview children, but that right is very rarely used. What happens is that a specialist report's obtained from a counsellor, psychologist or social worker as to what the child's views are. But of course the child's views are filtered through that person's interpretation of them. And particularly with older children, that can, the effect of that can be quite wrong. I must say that I didn't do it very much in my early days as a judge, but when I did it, I had no cause to ever regret doing it. And I know of several cases which I would have absolutely got wrong if I hadn't spoken to the children concerned during the case. But again, Australian judges won't do it. Though we made studies of the situation in Germany, revealed that it was common for German judges to interview children. They valued that very highly, but in fact it often helped to resolve family disputes, because when they had the child's point of view, they were able to talk to the parents with that in mind, and often resolve the dispute in an amicable way. So I think also one of our problems in relation to children's law in Australia is the use of adversarial proceedings. We all seem to be stuck in the mould of examination, cross-examination, evidentiary issues all the time, whereas, in fact, we should be looking at the way to get to the child and to work out what's best for the child, and that's not, I believe, done in that way. There are signs that that's changing in Australia, but it's still taking time. But I must say that there were two other factors that I want to touch on briefly tonight, which affected my views in relation to child rights and children. And they are the areas of asylum seekers and the areas of the treatment of Aboriginal people in our community. Let me turn first to asylum seekers, which is an issue that I had direct contact with. It will be recalled that the Keating government first acted to provide for mandatory detention of asylum seekers and set up a detention facility at Port Hedland back in the 90s. For those who don't know where Port Hedland is, it was remote. It's a remote town on the northwest of Western Australia, miles from any assistance, lawyers, supports or anything of that sort. I accepted an invitation to speak on the rights of children at the MCG around about that time. And I took the opportunity to criticise the government for setting up what I described as a virtual concentration camp in a remote area, and particularly for wrongly detaining children, contrary to the Convention on the Rights of the Child. That wasn't very popular with the government of the day, as you would imagine. There was a media hue and cry, and my remarks, I was criticised strongly as a judge for having made those statements. Strangely enough, the Australian newspaper took a different approach from what one would expect of it today. The immigration minister, Senator Baucus, was depicted in a cartoon dressed in a Nazi uniform outside a concentration camp, and even Greg Sheridan, their foreign editor, expressed support for what I'd said. So there's been a big change with them over the years. Subsequently, in 2001, a case came before the family court involving asylum seeker children, where it was argued that the court in its welfare jurisdiction could order their release from detention in the light of evidence as to their extreme psychological deterioration. On appeal, the full court over which I presided held by a majority of 2-1 that the court did have jurisdiction and ordered the children to be released. The minister released the children but promptly appealed to the High Court, which unanimously held we didn't have the jurisdiction. Normally, I suppose a judge might feel chastened by a unanimous defeat in the High Court, but I think I can say that I've never been as proud of any decision that I've made as a judge as I am of that one. I still think it was morally and I believe legally correct, even though the High Court thought otherwise. And I think other High Courts and earlier ones, such as the Mason High Court, might well have taken a different view. But in particular, I believe there's still room for the argument that there is sufficient adoption of the Convention of the Rights of the Child in Australian law for another High Court to take a more liberal view than it did on that occasion. But anyway, a practical result of the decision was the children were not returned to immigration detention, and revulsion against the practice of detaining children has gained force, albeit the government still does so, but it says it only does so for all sorts of reasons that it's difficult to understand. But anyway, we got somewhere. But the immigration debate continues, and I think it's fueled by the morally indefensible attitude of both major parties. The opposition's policy of turning around boats and reintroducing temporary protection visas is a combination, I believe, of criminal disregard for human life and refined cruelty, despite the crocodile tears shed in Parliament by its proponents. And the government policy of effectively scapegoating refugees by sending them back to the bottom of a non-existent queue in Malaysia in return for taking others is only marginally better, as is the so-called Nauru and PNG solution. And these, of course, are children were affected and families that are affected by this behaviour. And as for temporary protection visas that the opposition promote and some government members are wavering to reintroduce, people ought to remember the effect of those. The effect of those is that you get a temporary protection visa which does not enable you to bring your family to Australia. It separates you permanently from that family, and what the government hopes is you'll go home. But you may have nowhere to go, and that doesn't seem to worry them very much. And your family may be in terrible condition, living in terrible conditions in Southeast Asian countries without any proper support. I was interested to read a book the other day about a so-called people smuggler who commented that boats such as the boat that where 365 people were lost, called the SIEVX, was so full of women and children because that was the only chance they had of joining their husbands in Australia because their husbands had temporary protection visas. And this is the sort of behaviour that our leaders at the moment are continuing to engage in some kind of xenophobic exhibition designed to attract the worst feelings on the part of voters. And so I've got a lot more to say about that, but I won't go on with that. That's probably, we'll go on forever. the only other matter is the great shame of our Aboriginal policy. At the family court, I became concerned about the small number of cases involving Aboriginal people that came to the court's attention in places like Darwin, Alice Springs and Cairns, where Aboriginal people represent a considerable percentage of the population. We talked to a number of communities. We found that they were really frightened of courts. They didn't trust white courts. They didn't trust courts that might take their children away. And that was part of the problem. And they had a cynical view that our decisions would always favour the white person if there was one involved. We did overcome that problem by appointing Aboriginal Torres Strait Islanders as family consultants to work with the staff of our court and with the communities and act as a liaison. And I must say I gained greater insight into the problems of Aboriginal communities as a result. But then we had, in 2007, we had first the Stolen Generation Report, and the negative reaction of the then government, led by John Howard, his refusal to apologise for what had happened. In fact, I had a particular problem because I criticised that publicly in San Francisco at a conference in 1997. And when I was publicly attacked in the media in Australia and threats were made that my judicial position was under threat because I'd done so. But that's sort of part of the something that goes with the job from time to time. But we've recently had the spectacle of politicians engaging in a cynical and racist exercise to control Indigenous people since 2007 with a so-called intervention. I've had particular involvement with examining recent consultations in 2010 and 2012, which are supposed to justify the measures that the federal government recently introduced. The consultations were clearly a farce, they were a sham. They didn't properly consult the Aboriginal people, and even the Senate committee, which was packed with government and opposition senators supporting the government's position, even they found it hard to stomach the fact that these consultations had taken place. Yet this legislation passed through the House almost without debate, both in the House of Representatives and in the Senate a few weeks ago, and it will be enforced for the next 10 years. quite against the and without consultation with the Aboriginal people, quite against their wishes and desires. It's a national disgrace, and I'm very pleased to be able to draw attention to it to a group of young people, because I think that you people are the sort of people who've got the capacity and the ability to take these sort of issues further. Because we've really got to stop the sort of behaviour that our governments engage in, and the sort of spin that they engage in, and the sort of treatment that they dish out to Aboriginal people. It's the subject of constant criticism from international bodies, not least the recent report of the Committee on the Rights of the Child. But our governments don't even seem to have a sense of shame about these issues. They ride roughshod over the rights of minority people. They don't treat them with the respect that they deserve. And to me, one of the great challenges to child advocates and to young people interested in human rights is to take up the cudgel in relation to these sort of areas and have a go. And don't be frightened to say what you think, and don't be frightened by the pressures that might be put upon you by others who would wish you'd shut up. It's the mark of a person who wants to achieve anything in these areas that they've got to be prepared to get up and say what they think and say what they think is right. And I hope that with your interest in human rights, you will be inspired to do so. So thank you very much for listening to me, and I'll conclude on that note.
Next up, we have Associate Professor John Tobin, who is an Associate Professor in the Melbourne University of Melbourne Law School. He is a well-known advocate and academic in the field of human rights, and in particular working in the area of the rights of a child. He is currently working on a comprehensive commentary on the Convention of the Rights of the Child, and tonight he will be speaking to us about the UN Committee's review of Australia, including their main recommendations and concerns with Australia's children's rights record. So please welcome him.
Thanks so much for having me this evening. It's a great pleasure. And also, thanks for coming. It is cold outside. It's Melbourne. Apologies to the Queenslanders here, but we live in winter in Melbourne this time of the year. I want to start with a story of a student of mine, Jason Popjoy. Jason was a young man who was at law school about 5 years ago, a bit older than yourselves at the time. He was thinking about a career in media law, and he came to one of my classes on children's rights. And over the course of that time, he started to change his ideas about his career and his choices about what he'd do with his life. So much so that he started to pursue the interests of refugee children. As a consequence, he enrolled and went to Oxford and did a BCL, which is a very esteemed graduate degree. Spent a lot of time in the library, a lot of time looking at books. He started to enrol in a PhD, and his supervisor said to him, "You've got to get in the field, Jason. You've got to get your hands dirty. You've got to experience what it's like to be a refugee." He wasn't all that enthused by that prospect. He grew up in Eltham, nice suburb out in Melbourne, came to Melbourne University, hard worker, committed, but hadn't actually experienced what it would be like to live in a developing country. In any event, he went down to Uganda, and he spent about 3 months there. During that time, he met with hundreds of young boys and girls who were fleeing the Congo. You've heard of Joseph Kony, you've heard of what he did to young people. Well, this work that Jason was doing was interviewing the young people, the young boys and girls who had escaped the LRA and had escaped the various traumas being perpetuated in the Congo at the time. And he came across this young boy here. He wrote to me and he said, "John, I don't know what to do with this young man." He came to me last week, met me in a hall, explained what happened to him. His story began like this. He was with his father at home one night when rebels came in and shot him. He escaped with his older brother and his mother. The rebels pursued the family. They took the mother, who was pregnant at the time. She was so heavily pregnant, they actually cut open her stomach and executed the child in front of her, then executed the mother as well. During this time, the young boy and his brother had hid in the bushes and had escaped their own fatal end as well. So this young boy had seen both his parents killed in the most brutal way possible. And he came to Jason. Jason said, what can I do for you? What do you want? Having no concept of what he might actually want to achieve. Thinking about vengeance, retribution. Thinking perhaps this guy would be so broken there'd be nothing left him to actually offer. He said, "I want two things. I want to be listened to, and I want an education." You have both those things. You have both those things tonight, today, tomorrow. People listen to you. You're intelligent, you're educated, and you have the opportunity to go to a school, to go to a home. Not everyone does. And it strikes me every day when I work in this field how random life is, how random our choices are, how random it is that you're here tonight, not being homeless amongst the 22,000 Australians, young Australians, who don't go home to a safe and stable home. You've had opportunities that others don't have. And I suppose in my context, that says, well, what choices do I have to make then to make a contribution back to society? And I suppose tonight, what I'm asking you is, what contributions will you make? What choices will you make? Because your choices have a profound impact. You've heard from Jan and Alistair. They made profound choices that transformed the lives of young people. And I suppose the challenge for you tonight now is, what choices will you make today, tomorrow, and beyond about transforming the lives of other young people that work around you, both locally, nationally, internationally as well? So that's Jason's story. Jason is now completing his PhD. He's just set up, with the help of the Diana Fund, Princess Diana Fund, a special program for refugee children, £25,000, to develop a special service to assist refugee children. He'll do great things in his life, and a full credit to him as well. So beyond Jason, where do we go? Well, I'm a human rights sort of person, for better or worse, and I spend most of my time thinking about how human rights can be used to deliver justice. I understand your theme is, what is justice? A lot of competing ideas about what is justice, but for me, I like the idea of human rights, and especially the idea of children's rights. Okay, what I want to focus on here is really this, the wording here of the Declaration of Human Rights. I'm hoping you'll understand where this originated and the context in which it came to pass. Keep in mind, it was post-World War II, a period of unbelievable hatred, unbelievable suffering, and it brought together countries to adopt a vision of the world that might be far more just. Importantly, read the words carefully, and it says every individual, every organ of society has a role to play in promoting human rights. Not just about states. We're very critical of states, but in fact the challenge here is about what you will do as individuals to shape and create justice in your lives, the lives of those around you. Okay, so that's my first question. What role are you prepared to accept the challenge? So then moving forward, I've got the job of giving the technical legal side of things here, which can be a little bit dry at times, so I'll try and keep it lively if I can. So my, I suppose, advice to you would be that in terms of the law and international law, there are a few things that will shape and inform the contribution you might choose to make around pursuing and protecting human rights. The first thing is this thing called the Convention on the Rights of the Child. Now, I'm assuming you've all heard about this document. Show of hands, please. Yes? Okay, good. That's a very positive sign. The reality is most Australians don't know it exists. First challenge, persuading our audience that this is a relevant and important document. Ask your friends, ask your parents, ask your aunties and uncles, do they know about this document and what it represents? Chances are they don't know, and chances are they don't like the idea of children as rights bearers. It's about divorcing parents. In the US, it's about having access to drugs, rock and roll, having sex, a whole range of things that give rights a bad name for kids. But it's a controversial instrument. Bottom line is, this was a document adopted by states over a 10-year drafting period during the 80s and late 70s and throughout the 80s. Now, I won't go into the details other than to say that states, not you, not NGOs, but states, including Australia, agreed to accept the rights within that instrument. And those rights fall into three categories, what we might call provision rights, protection rights, and participation rights. It's important to understand that because it was the first instrument to put all those rights together and put them together for children as a distinct group. And that's always under the age of 18, not just sort of the five-year-old you might think of when you use the phrase child. Now, provision rights are easy. Education, health, housing. Okay, all things that are really important and which you're enjoying today in your lives. Okay, protection rights around things about violence, armed conflict, etc. Very important areas again as well. But the most radical aspect of this document was the participatory rights, particularly Article 12. Article 12 says that states must assure to each child who is capable of forming his or her view, the right to be heard in all matters concerning that child. A positive duty to actively take measures to allow you to be heard in all matters concerning you. Now ask yourself the question, what matters do not concern a child? It's very hard when you start thinking about the way in which our governments act. Most things impact on you either directly or indirectly. Budgets impact on you. Planning impacts on you, housing, education, schooling, juvenile justice, all these things impact on you. And what the convention is saying is that you have a right to be heard. And the government has an obligation to make sure your voices are in fact heard as well. The challenge is, do you want to make your voice heard, and how we make it heard as well? Okay, now the convention is an international legal instrument. Now this is kind of tricky here. It's not enforceable. So unlike our criminal law or our tax law, okay, which can be enforced domestically, we can't enforce the convention in domestic jurisdictions. So how does it actually operate? Well, what happens is there's a thing called the Committee on the Rights of the Child, a body of independent experts. They sit in Geneva and they say to each state, you must come to us every few years and give us a report card about your progress, how you're doing. Okay, it's like a bit like school in some respects, a discussion around how you're performing. So just last month in June, Australia appeared before the Committee on the Rights of the Child and was required to say how it's performing, okay? And sort of fess up about its strengths and its limitations. And as a consequence, the committee then issues what's called a set of concluding observations. Now, to be honest, it's a very boring document to look at. Very legal, very technical, but it's a really important document to be looking at because for me and for you and for our group this evening, it gives us a bit of a platform for action. Because what it's saying is the international community is saying these are the areas where we think the Australian government is falling down when it comes to protecting children's rights. Now, I'm going to ask you, in your own mind, what issues do you think are really important in Australia right now which are of concern to you from a child rights perspective? Throw me up some ideas, just topics and themes, groups that you think might be important or of concern to you in terms of the way rights are being protected.
Drug and alcohol use?
Yes. Keep going.
Asylum seekers.
What else?
Foster care.
Indigenous children? Refugees, yes.
Education.
Okay. You can pretty much go across every area of your life and start thinking your own day-to-day experience. Where do things come up where you think there's an injustice? I have four children young. Children identify, young people identify, adults identify justice, injustices very readily. When things aren't, when they're not fair. Bullying in schools, being silenced by a teacher, being denied access to appropriate representation in court. Young people know that, okay? All those things are concerns of the committee. And you'll see here just a sample of the issues the committee's identified as being of concern to the international bodies about what we are not doing. Lack of awareness of kids' rights. That's the first thing. We don't understand this idea in Australia, what it actually means. We're reluctant to engage with rights for a whole range of reasons. And we're very reluctant to engage with rights for young people. We're scared, I think, of young people, what it actually might mean to give you a voice. Okay? International aid. We don't carry our burden of what's required to contribute. At the moment, we provide 0.5% of GNP. We're asking for 0.7%. So we're falling short there as well. Participation across the board, but particularly in schools. The committee itself said within schools, there isn't sufficient voices for children to be heard in decision-making across every aspect of education. Curriculum, discipline, the whole range of areas where schools, in fact, affect the way you live. Now, ask yourselves and get your own jurisdictions and own experiences, do you, in fact, have a voice at school which is respected? I'm hoping you do, but not always the case as well. As Alice has identified, sterilisation of girls with disabilities, a key area. Healthcare in rural communities, mental health funding across the board. Rates of STDs. In Australia, we have a huge, enormous problem around sexually transmitted diseases and unwanted teenage pregnancies. Why is that happening, do you think? Well, what's required to address sexually transmitted diseases and unwanted pregnancies? What do you have to have?
Education.
Sex education, which is meaningful, driven by, informed by young people, but we don't always like doing that. We're scared of what it might mean to accept that young people actually have sexual relationships. They do. Respect them, empower them to use their sexuality, not just deny the right to actually understand what's taking place. School bullying. Who's experienced bullying in schools? Most of you probably have, okay, at some point in time. That's a critical issue, which is a local issue. It's not about the big, sometimes, issues you think globally. These things are all concerns for the Committee on the Rights of the Child and, as a group of people concerned, are all points of action to start leveraging and saying to the government, you need to lift your game. One of the things the committee says is that Australia is a very affluent country. Huge resources, but we're not doing enough to actually address the rights of young people as well. So an enormous range of challenges here, but things for us to be thinking about as, in terms of how we respond. Now, what I want to go back to is a previous slide. You'll see here this thing called an optional protocol. Now, what's happening, or what's happened late last year, was that the United Nations General Assembly adopted an optional protocol to the CRC. That's legalese talk, but basically means that from now on, there's a capacity for individual children within jurisdictions to make a complaint to the Committee on the Rights of the Child. So, for example, if you are aggrieved and your rights are violated and you have no redress domestically, then in theory, you can take a complaint to the committee. Now, stop. This mechanism is not yet in force. And one of the things Chris will be talking about is whether, in fact, you want to commit to lobbying our government to ratify the optional protocol. Okay, so it's a cause of action or a potential call of action for you to be saying, we will demand and petition our government to ratify this optional protocol to allow for individuals to, in fact, take complaints to the Committee on the Rights of the Child. So that's the first thing to be thinking about in terms of measures that are practical beyond this evening and tonight. What I want to also finish on in terms of the things that might inform your response is this idea of a National Commissioner for Children. This is a major development. For years, there's been an Australian Human Rights Commission, but there's been no dedicated Children's Commissioner. Again, a reflection of the fact that we've really sort of made children's rights invisible. People like Jan and Alistair have been agitating for change, but federally, our government's been reluctant to embrace this idea. Now, for the first time, there'll be a dedicated National Commissioner. Now, importantly, the mandate for this body is, or this person rather, is to promote awareness of children's rights, to undertake research around things that concern children, to actively engage with young people, i.e. you, about the things that matter to you, and then to examine all legislation against the standards under the Convention on the Rights of the Child. This is a significant development. And if you're thinking again about something that might come out of this meeting and your own work beyond this evening, it's about then lobbying, working with, engaging with that person when they're appointed to actually start defining the agenda for children's rights in this country. You'll be called upon to play an active role, and the choice again is there for you if you want to take that up. Very exciting development, I think, opens up a shift from the marginalisation of children's rights to them being placed much more centred in the way in which you do social policy in this country. Okay. But the warning. All right, there's big warnings here. Human rights, children's rights are controversial issues. This entire group might embrace the idea, but if you walk across to a different jurisdiction, discipline, or area, there's every likelihood they'll say that children's rights aren't useful, they're unhelpful, adversarial, litigious, a whole range of criticisms that you have to contend with. So you must be cautious about how you use this idea of human rights and children's rights. Not everyone embraces it, and you yourselves must be thinking about what it actually means. There's a couple of quotes here. The first is a classic quote from Carl Schmitt: whoever invokes humanity wants to cheat. What that's meaning is, and for you as a group is, don't just think that by using the children's rights card that you can win the argument. It's much more complex than that. You must persuade your audience about what you're arguing as to whether it's valid or not. Just simply relying on the rights argument as a moral argument is not sufficient. And the second, I think, is that constant thing in the back of our minds. Justice Hayden, High Court judge, look at what he says about human rights. This is extraordinary. It's gratuitous. I'm not sure why it figures in a judgment at all around the Victorian Charter of Human Rights. The odour of human rights sanctity is sweet and addictive. It is a comforting drug stronger than poppy, or whatever that word is, or all the drowsy syrups of the world. But the effect can only be maintained over time by increasing the strength of the dose. Be aware that many people in this country take the same view. They don't necessarily think human rights are a vehicle for achieving justice. In fact, they think, on the contrary, those who use it are addicted to something that has no substantive content. Now, I don't share that view at all, and I'm kind of upset with this comment, but you need to be aware of the challenges that lie ahead of you if you want to see the vision of justice being formed by human rights. It's a global, a regional, and a national challenge as well. Okay, so think strategically, think reflectively. Last thing I want to finish on is who inspires me. The reality is that, like all of us, I get very tired. I get overwhelmed with my workload. I was up five times last night to two children to wet their bed and three who had two had nightmares. So you get a bit tired with life. Then the challenge, well, what inspires you? Who inspires me? And this young girl often becomes the source that I go back to. Anne Frank. You all know Anne Frank's story, I'm assuming, yeah? Okay. So I'm just going to cite from you an extract from her diary very soon before she finished writing and passed away, keeping in mind she died before her 16th birthday. Keep this in mind when you're thinking about young refugees coming to this country, young people in care, young people in detention, young people who are homeless this evening, young people who aren't listened to, young people with disabilities. And she writes, so if you're wondering whether it's harder for the adults here than for the children, the answer is no, it's certainly not. Older people have an opinion about everything and are so sure of themselves and their actions. It's twice as hard for us young people to hold on to our opinions at a time when ideals are being shattered and destroyed, when the worst side of human nature predominates, when everyone has come to doubt truth, justice, and God. Anyone who claims that the old people have a more difficult time in the annex doesn't realise the problems have a far greater impact on us. We're much too young to deal with these problems, but they keep thrusting them upon themselves until finally we're forced to think up a solution. But most of the time, our solutions crumble when faced with the facts. It's difficult in times like these. Ideals, dreams, and cherished hopes rise within us, only to be crushed by grim reality. It's a wonder I haven't abandoned all my ideals. They seem so absurd and impractical. Yet I cling to them because, in spite of everything, I believe that people are truly good at heart. The challenge for us is to make sure that her words ring true. Good luck. Okay, thank you.
Finally, for tonight, I'd like to invite Chris Varney to the microphone. Chris is a passionate advocate for child rights and has been in a number of spheres and is an advocate for poverty reduction. He is a former Australian Youth Representative to the United Nations and a previous co-director of Vision Generation, the youth movement of World Vision. Currently, he serves on the steering committee of the Child Rights NGO Task Force and works in World Vision's Indigenous program. And tonight, Chris will be sharing stories of children and young people that formed part of the NGO Shadow Report to the UN Committee and providing us with those valuable action points to take this discussion beyond tonight's event.
"I have never felt like I meant much," said a 17-year-old in Port Pirie. "The violence in my childhood has led to me having schizophrenia," said an 18-year-old in Sydney. "I am 13 years old. I have been in and out of juvenile detention for the last 3 years. I think if I had more support, I would not do so much crime," said a boy in Adelaide. Three quotes from three different children and young people whose childhoods have seen violations of their rights. And three children as well who contributed in 2009 to a book called Dear Kevin, a book with the whole vision of which was to create a collection of children and young people's stories in their own terms, in their own way, that we would then give to decision makers and use in child rights advocacy. Unfortunately, 3 weeks ago, in honour of the advocacy results that we had achieved with this book, which at that point had reached a point where it had 789 letters, we finally gave it to Kevin Rudd. And in preparing this book, I had a flashback to being in Year 8 with art folios and things, because organising 789 letters was a bit of a tedious 4 days, but it was a nice relief after exams. But preparing all of this, there was no doubt in my mind which letter should be first. And it was the letter that I'll never forget, the one where its first opening line started with this: "My father's violence became so bad that I witnessed my mother being pinned against a wall with knives." I received it during my youth consultation in a South Australian homeless shelter. And the girl who gave it to me, who I will call Charlotte, gave it to me without hope or expectation that I would ever share it. I was quite shocked to receive the letter. This girl had been silent throughout the consultation. And when you're a youth rep, you have lots of different facilitation tools up your sleeve, but I had a really innate sense that I needed to leave this girl be and leave her alone. Now, she had such a sad and empty face that she was wearing, and to be honest, when I looked at it, I just had this flashback to moments where, in my time with anti-poverty campaigning, when I've been through communities in Tanzania and some of the poorest slums in India, it's been in those moments where, despite the material deprivation that children might be surrounded by, you know, they still have such strong spirits. And so to meet this girl that literally wore the face of a broken spirit in such a highly developed community as where she was in South Australia was quite shocking to me. Now, I was stunned when to read from her letter that she was only 17. She looked far older. And as I read on, it was easy to understand why. The violence of Charlotte's father in her early childhood was followed by her grandfather sexually abusing her when she was age 6. Tragically, Charlotte's cry for help was met with only silence from her parents. When she reached early adolescence, she turned to alcohol to cope. When Charlotte's family broke up, her mother remarried another violent man. To avoid further abuse, Charlotte fled to a homeless shelter, becoming one of the 22,000 young Australians that are homeless on any given day. Too often and too easily, children like Charlotte are silenced in our community. Now, when Kevin Rudd was looking through this book, when he's read that letter, and he's a phenomenally quick reader, when he ploughed through it, he said, "What do we do?" And really, that's the same question that, you know, we're here tonight to answer. We're here tonight to begin a discipline of follow-up so that these recommendations that the committee has made, that John has talked about, that Alistair's talked about, don't just stay words on a page and don't just live in that kind of UN genteel advocacy. They become, hopefully, something that you can actually use, a language of action that you can drive forward, whether it be in UN Youth, whether it be in a different youth organisation, whatever forum that you might take up. John's alluded to the fact that the committee's given these recommendations, but in a way, if I was to sum up what the committee's basically said, is that Australia has made, I guess you could call it, checkered progress on children's rights. There's been some great gains in recent years. We have new national frameworks that look at early childhood, reduction of violence. We have a children's commissioner, which involved a long slog to get that role established. These are really exciting to see. We have more youth movements than I've ever heard of. UN Youth, we've got Oak Tree, we've got Left Right Think Tank, VGen, AYCC. There are stacks of different ways that you can get involved, even with organisations like FYA and so many different NGOs. But we've also got very concerning trends. Things that are, in a way, engulfing vulnerable kids in our community. The first I thought I'd talk about was out-of-home care, and we're so lucky that Jan's here tonight. She's left an incredible legacy behind in that sector of how young people are helping each other, facilitating leaving care plans and actually really taking control of their lives. And in Geneva, when we were reporting to the committee as a group of NGOs, we had a representative there from CREATE who'd been in out-of-home care and stood up really proudly in front of the committee and talked about the work of that organisation. But in out-of-home care, we've had between 2005 to 2010 a 51% increase in the amount of kids placed in care. That's phenomenal. There's also a huge correlation between kids in care and kids in homeless situations, because kids in care, only about 1 in 3 of them have a leaving care plan. And so that figure of 22,000 young people at homeless on any given moment, many of them have come from care. And then to look at a different issue, juvenile justice, which you had Alistair briefly allude to. In this country, an Indigenous young person is 28 times more likely to be imprisoned in a juvenile detention centre than a non-Indigenous young person. Now, that figure, 28 times more likely, has only risen over the last 20 years. In 1993, it was 17%. Look at it now, 28%. The data was done last year in a huge parliamentary report. Now, when I was fortunate to be youth representative, I went around to 6 different juvenile detention centres and I met stacks of Aboriginal kids that were inside or kids that were in vulnerable situations from different ethnic communities. And one of the most frustrating things I had was when people would confront me and say, "Wow, that's innovative of you to go to a juvenile detention centre." It was almost as though they acted like, well, those kids don't deserve a voice. Yes, there are reasons why we have juvenile detention centres, and I've sat with young people that have done terrible crimes. But I've also met kids like that 13-year-old I talked about. And that boy, let me tell you, had a bright spark about him. the reason why he's in a juvenile detention centre is that mum or dad stacked the fridge too much of heroin and marijuana to make the school lunches of a morning. And so when he was desperate, he kept throwing rocks through 7-Eleven windows. And so for the last 3 years, he's been in and out of juvenile detention because to him, that's become the safest world he's ever known. I've met people that have told me, oh, well, juvenile detention is a growing industry. Now, whilst that's very doom and gloom and quite grim, I've also seen how it's through young people and our use of instruments such as the Convention on the Rights of the Child that we can actually be part of the solution, which is what all your speakers have talked about tonight. In 2009, and I want to talk about what Alistair mentioned, it's when you're doing this controversial work and sometimes feeling quite frightened with how outspoken you can be. I went to one detention centre known as McGill, and it's in Metro Adelaide. And everyone had emailed me throughout that year saying, if you're doing this work, you need to go there because that place is a terrible place for kids. And after I had about 10 emails telling me this, I went inside and no one had been allowed in. I, with the title of youth rep, was very lucky to kind of get a half-hour visit in there. And when I started asking questions of the wardens inside, they said, if you will take these views of the kids somewhere, we'll let you have a whole afternoon. And so 5 hours later, I walked out of this place, having done quite a wide consultation with kids there. And the things I heard were shocking. I learned that these kids barely had any opportunities to take up proper educational training. I mean, 3/4 of this building, McGill, had been shut down for OH&S reasons. The kids couldn't even have a real shower or go to the toilet properly because asbestos had rotted throughout the building so much that you had to stick a towel between your shower door and the shower frame. Now, I walked out of this place, and to allude to what Alistair was talking about, when you're in a role like that, you can make creative comments and be really blunt, and it's just part of being in that type of role. And I called McGill a living child rights abuse hell. And I wrote a media release that was very, just said everything, was very raw with its honesty. And that media release whipped around DFAT, oh, the youth rep's doing some controversial work here, let's rein him in, people. It got a lot of media in South Australia, and I had the Deputy Premier of SA, Kevin Foley at the time, who decided to call me this goody-goody two-shoes. He decided that I'd come out from New York, apparently, on a, you know, first-class flight, and who did he think he was? Well, actually, Kevin, I'd come on a Jetstar flight and, you know, sleeping on the couch of my friend Kat Stanfield, no first class at all. But actually, incidentally, I saw him 2 years ago in Washington when he was quite under the influence and approached him about that comment and, you know, we patched things up. It was all good there. But I got to the mission, the permanent mission of Australia to the UN, where the youth rep spends some time doing some advocacy, and I there confronted the full brunt of what I'd done. You know, they walked up to me and said, well, you really freaked us out with that and you're quite controversial. And in a way, they didn't really talk to me for a good 3 weeks. Sorry to freak you out with this, Dan. I called up a friend and I said, what do I do here? Having been quite controversial on this work and come out and said these things, how do I, you know, cope in this situation? And I got some great advice, and to follow on from what John was saying, when you're doing controversial work, my friend was saying, you know, find your wriggle room as an advocate. Find your wriggle room. And incidentally, about a month after my time in New York, the South Australian government, in response to that media and to a lot of different work of advocates, decided that they'd make a commitment to replace that centre by 2011. And the whole story in New York changed. You know, they looked at me in a very different way. They turned around at the end and actually threw a dinner in honour of what we've been able to do. And I think there's a powerful message in that, that actually you can throw money at anything. You can have as many people working on something as you can, but it's so much about your approach. And you as a young person, the most powerful thing you have is your voice. I was someone, when I was age 5, I was diagnosed with Asperger's syndrome, a minor form of autism. And my family was confronted with the moment where they needed to decide, how do we look after Chris in amongst all these psychiatric units and so-called specialists that thought they knew what was best to do for me? And my mum made a very smart decision that I'll never be able to thank her for enough. She said, I'm going to raise Chris with my own behavioural therapy and focus on his voice and build that up so that he has his own self-esteem. Because so many kids that wear a label grow up under the burden of that and don't get to develop their own self-confidence. And so what listening to children means and what having the right approach means, I think, is valuing what kids have to say, giving them some ownership and control in the decisions which affect their lives. Now, if we return to Charlotte, she, you and I are part of the first generations of Australians to grow up with the Convention on the Rights of the Child. You know, we have an incredible moment right now with the committee's recommendations to actually really make that, you know, our mantra going forward. We may have failed to implement her rights, but that doesn't mean we can't learn from her story. It doesn't mean that we can't use the convention as a tool to actually creating a culture where children are free to be children. Australia doesn't need to see this thing as a threat. It's actually a practical instrument that we can use every single day. And I believe that we can do that. Don't you? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chris, and to all of our speakers. I'm sure that you have bundled up those questions and are ready to go. So we will open it up. Feel free to direct your questions to any of the panel or generally if you'd prefer. So do we have any questions for the panel? Do we have roving mics? Yep, just up the front here. Just hang on for the mic. And just remember, if you're part of the National Conference, to mention your name and the state that you come from, just so that we get a feel for that.
I'm Billy Jo from NT. To Alistair, what was your involvement with the Aboriginal thing in 2010 and 12?
Yes, well, what happened was I was asked, can you hear me? Yep, I want to make sure it worked. I was asked by a group called Concerned Australians in Melbourne, who had put in a lot of work in relation to issues relating to the intervention, to examine a series of videos taken of the consultations. I think I sat and watched about 30 hours of these videos, which was fairly intensive, but the idea was that these were taken at, I think, five different locations, might have been six. The consultations were held at many other locations, but these were the only ones we were able to get access to. But they were quite geographically separate and they were quite different people. And what became quite clear was that the people were not being consulted at all. They were being told what the government wanted to do, and they were given on occasions there may be an alternative, but that was about it. There was no consultation saying how do you think we could overcome this problem. The whole thing was directed at trying to get some going through the motions. And of course there were no interpreters, they were Aboriginal people. They were using some of the local Aboriginal people as interpreters. But there was no real attempt at communicating. And of course, these meetings were not set up in any sense to invite people to come and give them plenty of notice and have plenty of time to sit down and discuss. It was really a fly-in, fly-out exercise where the public servants came in and all took notes and off they went. Now, that happened in 2010. And you would have thought in 2012, when they went through the exercise again, that they might have done better, but they didn't. We had the same sort of picture emerged. What happened in 2012 was that the government produced a booklet, which was in very dense legal terminology, which was distributed, I think, in most communities on the day that the government group arrived, or shortly before that time. And the language of it was almost incomprehensible. And it didn't, in any event, indicate it wasn't an issue for consultation, it was saying what the government thought. So the whole thing was so contrary to any idea of consultation. I was shocked because I couldn't believe that they could have done the same thing again. They did have a few interpreters the next time, but that was all. So that really caused me to take part in the publication of two books or two booklets in which a group of us got together and examined the obligation to consult and then pointed out how far below that this fell. Indeed, the Human Rights and Equal Opportunity Commission, which is now the Australian Human Rights Commission, also put out a series of guidelines, and they failed every one of those guidelines. So it was just, it was a farce. And in the 2012 consultations, it was done against a tight timeline. There were many people who were not consulted. They would turn up at places and there'd be hardly anyone there because there'd be perhaps a death in the family or in that group, so the people wouldn't come. The consultation would proceed. It was a... I think it was a cynical exercise in trying to they were trying to comply with the Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples and the Declaration, or the other Declaration, I've forgotten which one it is now, but they had to, in order to create the legislation as not racially discriminatory, they had to describe it as a special measure, and one of the as a special measure for the benefit of the people concerned, and one of the tests is that you've got to hold consultations to determine whether the people agree that that is a special measure. And of course, there's no question of agreement at all. So it's a long answer, but it is probably worth saying.
Next question. We'll just go right up the back in the last row.
I'm Tessa from New South Wales. Given that Indigenous children and children who grow up in out-of-home care often have the highest rates of recidivism in jails or juvie, what do you think that we as a society, as a community of young people, and as the government, can do to not only change policies but change social perceptions about this?
Perhaps Jan, if
you'd like to try. For us, certainly, I think the major issue and the absolute leveller in this country, and which is why there's no excuse, we have no excuse, is education. Education changes everything for young people in care and for Indigenous young people. And the greatest travesty right now is that the report of last week, which said that the gap is going to be wider in terms of Indigenous outcomes for young people in education than it is meant to be at this time, after millions and millions and millions of dollars has been thrown at it, is just actually disastrous. And for young people in care, everybody knows that actually getting an education, staying in school, is the only chance to actually create a different pathway. And so the right to an education for me in this country is one of the greatest travesties because of who we are and because of this country and because of the fact that education is meant to be freely available to everyone. And if we don't stand up about that most basic right, I don't know where we go. I really don't. And we can play around the edges with all kinds of other issues around things like, you know, and advocating for young people in care not to have 10 and 12 and 20 different placements. But honestly, education, staying at school, staying in the one school and having that continuity will makes every bit of difference.
There are quite a few hands, but we'll just go down. Yeah.
Hi, I'm Nick from the ACT. This question is broadly addressed, but I guess to Chris in particular. When there's so little awareness that the intervention has more or less been extended for 10 years, and there's so little awareness of the massive increases in youth homelessness, and when Lady Gaga has more followers on Twitter than Barack Obama, is social media actually the tool for social justice and youth justice that it's purported to be?
I guess, like, my view on social media is that it's one of many tools you have to use to reach social justice. There's so many different avenues. Like, I personally find Twitter very frustrating.
I don't know, I'm not naturally a very witty person, so I sit there and go, how am I going to craft something actually worth reading here for, in like, whatever, how many words it might be? But I think, in simple answer to your question, you have to find every single avenue. Certainly, as Jan was saying at the very beginning, like, the advantage with that social media is that it's instant communication. Statistics, you know, very telling things can be told about straight away. I think that's, you know, that's the really, when you look at it just from a social justice perspective, that's the beautiful opportunity with it.
Can I just add on that as well? There's a very good article written in the New Yorker, I think last year, about this very issue. And the author was saying that, in fact, they're actually quite harmful sometimes to social change because the nexus between the Twitterers or the Facebookers is very, very shallow. Mm. And social change requires deep leadership, which is coordinated and structured and well thought out. And you go through society, and history is generally the case as well. So I think the answer to the question is it's a tool, but it can't be used in isolation with other traditional forms of sort of action building plans in terms of deep, well thought out planning and strategy with leadership. That is a vision about where you want to take it forward as well. But it's New Yorker, I can't remember the author, but it'll be easy to Google and bring it up. Yeah,
I'd just like to add one thing on that.
In my view, that one of the real advantages of Twitter is the way you can, for example, pick up a good article on the net and then circulate it to a lot of people. Mm. So you can actually get much longer than simple tweets out to the people around. And quite often, you can, particularly if you've got some connections to news networks, that sort of thing will actually generate news and coverage. So I think we've got to think of it a bit more than that short few words that you can use.
Keep at it, Chris.
I'm just up the front on the side there.
Hi, I'm Catherine from Western Australia. My question is for Alistair. Do you think that the current protections in the Australian political and legal system, for example, common law, are adequate in protecting human rights, like child rights? Or do you think a statutory Bill of Rights would be more effective?
Oh, unquestionably, yeah. A Bill of Rights, our failure to pass a Bill of Rights, to introduce a Bill of Rights, I think is a blight on our democracy. Because most of the worst abuses that have taken place by government over the last 10-15 years would not have occurred if they'd been open to challenge under proper human rights legislation. In fact, I'm amazed that there's not a much stronger movement in support of introduction of human rights legislation. The Conservatives have this strange approach that our rights are protected by everyone, so you don't need it, and that lawyers will make a picnic out of it and so on. But the reality is that we're not protected. Once you get a situation, you've got a government now in Queensland, which is has a huge majority, extremely conservative government. Already the signs are that it'll start trampling on rights in all directions. We saw the federal government when the Liberals had control of both houses. Then the worst excesses of the Howard regime occurred then. And I don't accept the Labor Party either from that. I think they're engaging in human rights abuses in relation to Indigenous matters and in relation to asylum seekers, none of which they would get away with if we had those sort of protections. And to me, the real problem with our society is that we don't protect minority people. And that's really, I think, the mark of a civilised society that you do. And I think a Bill of Rights is absolutely essential to do that.
Unfortunately, we only have time for about two more questions, but I'll try and pick them carefully. In the sweater, there.
Hi, I'm Sarah from the Northern Territory. I guess this is best directed towards Chris. Now, coming from a school where is this on? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay,
hear
cool. You just looked like you couldn't. Coming from a school where about 50% of the students are Indigenous, I can personally see the effects of hard home lives and misunderstood cultural concepts, as about only 8 to 12 Indigenous students out of around 300 all up successfully pass year 12 each year. So now my question to you is, after your alarming figure of how more likely it is for Indigenous students to end up in youth detention centres,
yes.
Youth detentions, my question to you is, how as young adults we are able to widen these ideas and help in order to promote more valuable like community living lives for Indigenous students?
From this whole panel can add lots to that, but I guess from the work I was doing, hearing the stories of Indigenous kids in those detention centres, what frustrated me the most was the real absence of proper reintegration programs and support mechanisms in the community, the completely inadequate educational opportunities out there in their communities. I heard from one girl in particular how, you know, there just wasn't proper transport out in her community, and so boredom, a whole range of factors would see her, you know, offend and commit crimes. So in terms of widening the understanding, I think detention shouldn't be seen as this solution. You know, detention in the convention is a last resort. It's always within that frame. And so I think what we need to do as a generation of young Australians is promote these concepts of reintegration, promote these concepts of community-driven support, and really build up what we can do in communities, rather than seeing detention as this, okay, lock them up, you know, that's where it can happen. And really, detention under the convention is where rehabilitation should be taking place. So it's a system of working through community-driven initiatives and actually working within the detention centres themselves, so that we are both doing rehabilitation, reintegration and community support. But I'll let the rest of the panel add to that.
Perhaps I could just comment in relation to the issue of detention. I mean, the first question that should be asked is, why are detention rates so high in the Northern Territory and Western Australia? Why are they so much higher than in other states? And what is the value of simply detaining people in these circumstances? Mm-hmm. I think in our society we've become, I think through the effects of Murdoch-style media, we've become much more inclined to accept really that the only solution to any form of antisocial behaviour is locking people up for longer and longer periods. And at the same time, we're not prepared to address the issues of what happens when we do, or what happens when they get out. That to me, I just don't understand why it's necessary to lock all these people up. And usually the offences they commit are pretty minor. I might commit a few of them, but the Western Australians, of course, have mandatory detention in certain circumstances, which is, again, contrary to the convention. But I just think we should be questioning this whole lock-up ethos, whether it's young people or anyone, for that matter.
And for our final question, if we could just go in the middle there. Yep.
I'm Kapil from Victoria. John, I think it was, you were talking about how youths have the right to be heard. Do you think that youths should have a stronger influence in important political issues and decision-making processes and such things as Parliament? And so something like a youth party, for example, should be created? And what's your opinion on that?
A really good question. My answer is, I'd like to see what you have to say, I suppose, is the correct answer. And my sense is yes. And I discuss this issue in my classes as well. And ask yourself, why don't young people vote? Why is it that under the age of 18 you're not allowed to vote? And go through the reasons that are given. Ask your parents, ask your friends. Don't fight about it at home. But just find out what reasons they give you. And most of those reasons have no foundation. And they're all used to discount the ability of women to vote and other groups to vote in society as well, and have now been discredited. So that's the first thing. What are the assumptions we make about young people's ability? And most of those assumptions are, in fact, false. So if they're false, then the answer would be, okay, if a child wants to make a contribution to discussions, why shouldn't they have a contribution to make? Which is why I suppose I'm throwing it back to you. I think you should be heard. You have a right to be heard. And importantly, what's kind of funny about this is that when young people's voices are heard, the outcomes are actually better. No surprise perhaps for you guys as well, but when we actually integrate your views into policies that affect you, then the outcomes are more sustainable, they're more effective, and they actually work as well. So I suppose in short, my answer is yes. Very difficult political challenge, but that's where I throw it back to you guys as well. That's what has to be done, I think, to transform the way we think about our political participatory models in this country. We don't listen to your voices at all.
Yeah.
Okay, we are going to have to wrap up the questions tonight. And to conclude the evening, I'd like to invite Geraldine to lead us in tonight's call to action to, I guess, operationalise some of the ideas we've been talking about.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate being invited to this event. It's great to see that that youth have so much energy and your enthusiasm and particularly like listening to Chris, the dynamism of youth, that you've been able to prepare this event and to be sort of on the same stage as these wonderful speakers tonight. But it's all of you here, the engaged and committed youth of Australia, that you have the power to change many of the things that are still very distressing and completely unjust human rights issues that were discussed here tonight. The UN Committee on the Rights of the Child has reinforced so many of the realities that we live and breathe here every day and has renewed our strength to make it clear again. We need to make it clear again and again for as long as we need to that it is not okay. It's far from okay that 50% of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people live in poverty across Australia. It's not okay that our children make up 40% of the children in out-of-home care in Queensland and are 10 times more likely across Australia of being removed from their homes and families. Or as Chris has said, it's not okay that our children are 20 times more likely to be in juvenile detention. None of it's okay. Every child in Australia has a right to grow up with their basic needs of shelter, food, health, love, care and education. And it doesn't matter where they're from. It's just the basic standard that we're asking for. I'm hopeful that with your efforts, that Australia and the struggle of those most disadvantaged children will be in a very different place in the future. I really believe they deserve you, the youth of Australia, to start working on their behalf. It's really difficult for Aboriginal communities to do it by themselves. We can't. I've been struggling, worked in this area for over 35 years. You've heard about the gap not closing. I personally have been involved in the fight so that we would narrow that gap. We seem to be banging our heads up against a brick wall. We've heard about from Alistair about what's happened in relation to the intervention in the Northern Territory and about lack of consultation. That lack of consultation, Alistair, not just happened in that situation, it happens all across Australia. We're, in actual fact, just listening here tonight and thinking about, sort of what me personally and the work that I've done and me personally that the work that I do now, that we, in actual fact, are still accepting handouts. We are still accepting government handouts. We struggle. The organisations that I'm in, we struggle on pitiful amounts of funding, really. I know the other NGOs do a great job, and they do a wonderful job, but they're the preferred providers to start working with our community people. They are funded way and above more than what Aboriginal organisations receive. I really believe, and I spoke to Alistair, people from FACSIA, and about what's happening in the Northern Territory, and I said, please, for goodness sake, go into those communities and talk to those communities and listen to what they have to say and work in partnership with them. Because if we don't start doing that, if we don't start working with our kids, we need to start working for, sort of with our communities and with Aboriginal people, government and the Australian community, then we aren't going to get anything better than what's previously happened. The gaps are widening. We've got children in those communities, which is really distressing and frightening, Alistair, that they are seeing their parents have, all responsibility being taken away. They're seeing that happen, that it's government that controls their lives. Just imagine just how those children are going to grow up. What needs to happen is it needs to be that we're that people are aware that Aboriginal children and Torres Strait Islander children in Australia should have child's rights. And I think that you, you know, the youth, if you just even consider think of assisting in any way, that you should. And I would really implore you to start thinking about and working for all children in Australia, but in particular those Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. Now, I've been asked to read out this pledge to you about, it's out the front. It's in relation to I've lost my place here, Chris, but about the optional protocol. But I just wanted to read, this is the pledge, and it's about Australia's Children's Rights Pledge. And it says that from this moment forward, I pledge my support to the principles of the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child, hoping that in the Australia of today and tomorrow, children's well-being will be put first, when at different times in our history it has been put last. I share the dream of the Convention for all children to enjoy all their rights to life, development and non-discrimination, and to protection, participation and the promotion of their best interests. I will educate and empower others on children's rights using my networks, my communities and affiliations so that this dream is a reality for every child in Australia. And I'd just like to thank you that for listening to me, and I hope that you will sign that pledge and the petition calling on the Australian government to ratify the optional protocol to the CRC on individual communications. Thank you.
That concludes tonight's event, and I do hope that you take on board the idea of the pledge and of the petition which encourages the Australian Government to sign on to the third optional protocol to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, the one that was spoken about in relation to those children whose rights have been infringed, being able to bring those issues directly to the committee who monitors the convention. So consider the words of the pledge, and I encourage you to sign up to it in the foyer outside. And I'd like to extend a warm thanks to our speakers from tonight. I'm sure you'll agree with me that to have the experts in the field truly reaffirms the ideas that we're talking about and puts a name and a face to the struggle for child rights and hopefully encourages you to join that struggle. So a big thank you to Jan Owen, Alistair Nicholson, John Tobin, Chris Varney and Geraldine Atkinson for coming along tonight.